Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to talk about the world of insects, and our guest is P.J. Leash back with us. He manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, has degrees in biological sciences and entomology, and he'll talk about insects that are emerging at this time of the year, and of course, take your bug-related questions. So I hope you join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. P.J. Leash, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here, Larry.
We've been hearing a lot of stories about the 17-year cicadas, and I don't think we're going to see them here in Wisconsin, but they will be affecting some parts of the Midwest, won't they?
Yes, you're absolutely right, Larry. The cicadas we're hearing about at the moment are what we refer to as periodical cicadas, meaning they come out at these very big, long intervals. For some groups, it's 13 years. For this particular group this year that we're hearing about, Brood X or Brood 10, it's a Roman numeral for 10. Brood 10 comes out every 17 years, and we won't see them here in Wisconsin, although you don't necessarily have to travel that far if you really wanted to see them. Parts of the Midwest, like Indiana, is going to have a lot of activity. And even parts of East Central Illinois will see some of this brood, as well as areas around Pennsylvania and parts of Tennessee, Georgia, North Carolina, and so on. So if you lived in say, southeastern Wisconsin, you could drive a couple of hours south and east a little bit, and you could potentially bump into some of these.
And our brood, I think that's coming in about 3 years, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So it's been 14-ish years since we last had a big emergence here in Wisconsin. So brood 13 is the brood that we will see here in parts of southern Wisconsin. They're going to be out in 2024. They were last out in 2007. So if you do want to see some of these periodical cicadas in Wisconsin, we just have to wait a couple more years. And if you really wanted to see them, a good place to go would be like the Lake Geneva area in southeastern Wisconsin. I usually think of that part of the state as having a lot of those periodical cicadas when they do emerge.
You know, we got an interesting email from Joyce in Marshall. She says last year they were camping at Southern Kettle Moraine and noticed there were trees with large cicada-looking shells attached to the bark. How can that be if this is the if this is the year of the cicada in some parts of the country? Do some of them get it wrong? Are there similar beetles that look like cicadas but aren't?
Yeah, so great question. And there could be a couple things going on. And the first thing I would point out is that so we do see cicadas every year. We have a bunch of different species here in Wisconsin, and some of them we commonly refer to as dog day cicadas because they pop out during the warm dog days of summer. So if the emailer had spotted these in, say, July or August, it most likely was one of the common species that we see every year, and sometimes you can bump into these in decent numbers. Another thing that could have happened, though, so with these periodical cicadas that come out every 17 years, there are sometimes individuals that pop out of sync, and we refer to those as stragglers because they don't keep up with the rest of the group. I did have some reports of these last year, actually, Larry. So I had some reports from Lake Geneva area. I had a report from Dane County, and there were quite a few reports in Chicago here. So that's another slight possibility as well, as it might have been periodical cicadas that popped out slightly out of sync. Otherwise, if it were later in the year, like July, August, it might have just been some of our common dog day cicadas.
Very, very cool. Let's take a call. Randy and Elmwood, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
I have a gnat problem. I believe they're gnats. I have horses, and the gnats come this time of year, and they drive the horses insane. They run from one side to the other. They bleed. Nothing we found seems to want to keep those gnats off those horses. Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, so what it sounds like to me, and this is something that I've been getting quite a few reports of around the state just in the last couple of weeks, to me that sounds like you might be encountering black flies. And black flies are a type of small fly from the family Simuliidae. We have about two, three dozen different species here in the Midwest. There's a few that will bite humans, but sometimes these can be quite a pest for livestock, large animals, cows, horses, and things like that. They can bite and draw some blood because they are blood feeders, and it can be a concern sometimes in agricultural situations. Unfortunately, though, we're a little bit at the mercy of Mother Nature with these black flies. They come out, and for a given species, the adults might be active for several weeks at a time, and there aren't great ways to eliminate them because the source that they come from, which is often a stream or river, could be some distance away from us, and they can blow in or get or fly in some pretty long distances. For something like horses, one of the best things to perhaps try would be to use some of the topical spray-on pyrethroid-based repellents. That may help to a certain extent. I know for horses, there are various fly masks you can put on and maybe a light sheet if it's not too warm, just to limit and reduce the contact from the flies and the horse. Otherwise, if they are really bad, a consideration might be to keep the horses indoors or more in their stables. Or if you have an area that has pretty good airflow, a decent breeze, that might help as well. But unfortunately, there's not a great solution for these. We just have to let things run their course.
Oh, sorry for that, Randy. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you. Folks have been finding ticks for a while this year, but of course that's going to increase with more time spent outdoors. What can we do to protect ourselves from ticks?
Yeah, so quite a few different things there, and you're absolutely right. I've been getting tick reports now for a couple of months, and I like to remind folks that basically any time that it's above freezing and that snow is off the ground, or even if there's a little bit of snow still here and there, you can potentially bump into ticks. So I have bumped into ticks, for example, in February and in warmer years. I started getting reports of ticks here in the state back in about March or so. So they are definitely out. They have been out for quite a while. There's a number of precautions, though, that we can all take to help avoid ticks. Very easy thing, if you know that there is a certain area that just seems to have a lot of ticks, that might be a certain park or a certain hiking trail that you go to, you might just choose to go elsewhere simply to reduce your exposure. So that's one very easy decision, is to avoid those areas where you've encountered lots of ticks in the past. Some other things you can do, though, wearing long sleeve clothing so that you have a barrier between your skin and the ticks, especially on the lower half of the body, because ticks are basically crawling up from lower on the ground or on low vegetation. They're not dropping down out of trees and things like that. So if you have on long pants and if you're going into a heavy tick area, you could even consider tucking your pant legs into your socks so that you have basically a complete barrier there. That's going to make it harder for the ticks to get to your skin. We also have repellents like DEET and Picaridin, and there's a number of other EPA-registered repellents that have documented effectiveness in terms of repelling ticks. There's also some longer-lasting products which contain permethrin. And this is a compound that actually has insecticidal properties. So it's not a type of product you apply to your skin. Rather, you apply these permethrin treatments, which you can get at outdoor clothing stores like REI and Gander Mountain and stuff like that. or order it online. You apply it to a pair of pants that you use for hiking or gardening. You can apply it to hiking boots and things like that. And it actually provides some long-term protection. It can last through many washes. You can also sometimes buy outdoor clothing that has this material already built into the fabric. The fabric is impregnated with it. And that can be a very, very good option, especially if you spend a lot of time outdoors, if you're into fishing or hunting or hiking, that sort of thing. And then one final thing, make sure to do tick checks on yourself. Any kids or grandkids, and also your pets as well. And an important reason to do tick checks is that if you were to, say, be bitten by a tick like a deer tick, for a deer tick to transmit Lyme disease, they actually have to be attached for a fairly significant length of time, about 36 to 48 hours or so. And what that means is if you go for a hike today at noon and you do a tick check when you get back or even later this evening, we're going to be removing those ticks before they have a chance to transmit Lyme. So that can be an important thing as well. And for pets, not only check them for ticks, but make sure they are getting a preventative flea and tick treatment if they're spending time outdoors. So there's lots of different things that we can do, Larry, to protect ourselves from ticks.
Yeah. And there's what do you think of these little implements? They're small, but they are tick removers, so to speak.
I have bumped into them. I've seen a number of different devices. Some are kind of like tweezers. Some are basically like a crowbar to kind of pry the tick up. And those certainly can work. Just a general word of advice, though, there's a lot of kind of remedies and different methods discussed for removing ticks. Sometimes folks suggest smothering them with Vaseline or burning them. And we really don't want to do stuff like that. We really don't want to twist them either, because that might increase the chances that some of their mouth parts tear off when they're in our skin. So if you have one of these devices or even forceps that we can get down at the base of the mouth parts and just gently pry upwards without twisting, that's going to be perhaps the best way to remove ticks.
And what about this tick app? Tell us about that.
Yes. So I have some colleagues here on campus with the CDC Center of Excellence in Vector-Borne Disease. And a couple of years ago, they developed what's called the Tick app. And it simply is a smartphone app available for phones and tablets. So Apple and also Android devices, you can download it. And it helps researchers gather information about ticks. And this is important because the tick situation, it's still evolving in Wisconsin. We didn't find our first deer ticks in the state until the late 1960s. So we have a pretty good idea of where ticks occur, but there's still more to learn. And so what you can do when you download this app, the app has a lot of great information on it. It can tell you basics of tick biology, tick removal and precautions and things like that. But there's also an option to fill out a daily survey. And the survey is a series of questions, maybe about 8 to 10 questions. It takes all of about 2 minutes to fill out. And it simply asks you, did you do outdoor activities today? If so, what kind of things did you do? Did you do gardening in your yard? Did you hike in a local park? That sort of thing. And so it's a really quick way to contribute some information that is then used by researchers here on campus to help get a better idea of what prime tick habitat looks like for us, both here in Wisconsin, but also participants are using this across other parts of the U.S. So it's helping researchers and scientists gather a lot of good data.
Patty in Eden has something for us. Let's go to Patty. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to let everyone know that I spent every spring, early summer up in the Hayward area, and wood ticks would be dropping off of trees and shrubbery as we walk through. And we had to check ourselves every day because that's what happens when you're up north near the Hayward area. It's not deer ticks, it's wood ticks.
Yeah. Comment, PJ?
Yeah, so, I mean, wood ticks can certainly be very common. I've spent plenty of times in the Northwoods myself, but when researchers have looked, they found that ticks are basically crawling up from lower areas rather than dropping down from trees, and there's a very good reason for that. If you are a tick, for example, one of the biggest threats to your survival is drying out or desiccation. And it turns out that ticks, we know on a daily basis, will often climb up to the tops of weedy grasses and low-lying plants and things like that. And if they start drying out too much in the sun, they'll actually go down to ground level to kind of absorb some more moisture before they go back up again. So they're always having to rehydrate, so to speak. And for them, it wouldn't make sense to climb way up into a tree because it's going to be too dry up there for them. So that's often something that I hear folks talk about. But when tick researchers have looked at that, they're finding that they're coming up from lower areas. Now, if you do get a tick on you, say on your shin or on your knee, they very quickly, sometimes in a matter of just a few minutes, can get up onto your neck or scalp or shoulders. And that may give the impression that they're falling from above, but they're simply crawling upwards from below.
PJ Leash, our guest today, he directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking about insects on the show today, and you're going to encounter many of them in your garden. And if you're getting busy in your garden, we have a new blog post up to help you with your plant selection. It includes ideas for cool weather plants, compact shrubs, and how to add year-round fragrance. And that's something we all like. Just go to WPR.org/Larry and look for our blog post. There's lots of good blog posts there, but that's the latest one I wanted to mention. Well, Mark, before we go to Mark, I wanted to go to Joe in River Falls, who sent this photo and has some bugs on there, and he wonders what they are. PJ, you can see them, I believe.
So Jill did share those photos with me, and this is an unusual type of insect. It's a type of scale insect, and if you haven't encountered scale insects before, I'd encourage you to hop online and just do an internet search for them. Scale insects are bizarre-looking insects, and for the most part, they don't even look like insects. These insects have a life strategy where rather than being mobile and moving around lots, they essentially hunker down in place, and they cover themselves with a waxy protective coating, and often they end up having this appearance that looks more like a disformed bud on a plant. And so in this particular case, the individual had sent in some pictures. It looks like a species, most likely the European fruit Lacanium or a close relative of that, and these brownish kind of swollen blobs that are on the twigs in these pictures, they can be fairly common on fruit trees, but also landscape trees and well. And as I said, Larry, what they do is they kind of glue themselves in place and they sit there protected. And they use a mouth part kind of like a mosquito, which they use to pierce into the plants. And they will then suck sap and fluids out of the plant.
Interesting. Well, Mark in Wisconsin Dells, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, I want to destroy, annihilate, kill, smash, bash every cutworm in the world. How can I do that?
Cutworms.
Oh, so cutworms. We actually have lots and lots of different cutworm species out there. And so management isn't just a clear-cut set of one single set of instructions. You'd really have to look at different cutworm species. We have some cutworms, for example, that actually migrate up here to Wisconsin every single year, things like black cutworm and so on. And depending on the national weather patterns and the jet stream and stuff like that, that's going to influence how many of those we're going to see in a given year and how bad the problem may be. We do have other species of cutworms that are more local, so to speak. They can survive our winters up here and do better in our own habitat in Wisconsin. And so those, if you have a population of them in your area, you might be seeing those every single year. Now, it depends a little bit in terms of the types of plants you're dealing with. When I think of cutworms in my mind, I often think of problems in certain field crops like corn. but also in garden settings, we can have some problems with cutworms as well. Now, there are a few things that we can do to deal with them. First, I would go out and really confirm that they are cutworms, and many of the cutworm species might be a little bit more active after dark. So going out after dark with a flashlight and looking at a garden area can be really helpful as well. We do have a number of conventional garden treatments that you can get at a garden center, hardware store, things like that, that you can use in gardens. There are some organic options as well, such as pyrethrins or Bacillus thuringiensis. Some of the trade names for that product are things like Dipel, also spinosad, which is in the product Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew, can work against cutworms as well. But some advice, if you are spraying for cutworms, it's going to work much better against smaller caterpillars compared to large caterpillars. If you have cutworms that are an inch and a half long, those are going to be really difficult to kill no matter what you're treating them with. Some other things you could try, especially if you have a smaller garden, I had mentioned that they like to be more active at night sometimes, and they like to hide during the day. And it makes sense. If you're a big, fat, juicy, plump caterpillar and you're out during the day, a bird might spot you and eat you. So they often like to hide during the day. So what you could do is in the rows in your garden, you could put down an old shingle, a board, a piece of cardboard, something like that, to give them hiding spots during the day. And then you could go out there during the day and flip those over, spot those cutworms and squish them. That would be another approach you could do. You may have to do that every single day, but that would be a non-chemical approach that you could do. So you kind of need to look at these different management approaches and tailor it for your situation, small garden, big garden, and so on.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. Back to ticks for a minute. A listener emailed that he saw on public TV a man in Nantucket, Massachusetts, trying to introduce a gene into the local mice that would prevent tick disease in human. It's up for a vote in the community. Are you familiar with this, and what do you think?
Yeah, so I have heard a little bit about the situation. Personally, I don't know too much about it, though, but it does bring up an interesting point. And when we look at ticks and tick-borne diseases, it can be a very complex situation. I mean, these ticks themselves live for 2 years, so they've got this long and prolonged life cycle. They also have this intricate interaction with mammals such as mice, and larger animals as well. And so researchers are looking at a whole bunch of different ways to go about reducing and tackling the tick and Lyme disease problem. And so some groups are trying this approach of, altering the rodent population and seeing if that might help. Because in theory, if the rodents couldn't catch and serve as a reservoir of Lyme or other diseases, then when ticks bite them, the ticks wouldn't pick it up. So that'd be one way to go about it. And I think that's what is being hinted at with that project. Some other researchers, including folks here in Wisconsin, are basically looking at some methods to either treat animals directly, like mice, where you can get them to take treated cotton balls, and that is going to kill the ticks directly on them. Or some folks are even looking at vaccines in a feed bait box as a way to vaccinate mice and small mammals so that they won't get the disease and therefore the ticks won't transmit it. So as I said, I don't know too much of the specifics about that project in New England. Mm. I've heard just a little bit about it, but it's one of the many ways that researchers are trying to look at and tackle this overall tick and Lyme disease and other disease problem.
You mentioned cotton balls, and Bob in Claybanks wonders if soaking cotton balls in pyrethrum and putting them in cardboard tubes is a good way to get ticks. Tick tubes, he calls them, and do golf courses have lots of ticks?
Yeah, so the second question first, golf courses, I generally wouldn't expect to have many ticks on areas like the fairways. It's simply too open, too sunny, too dry. I mentioned a couple minutes ago that drying out and desiccation is a major threat to ticks. So they wouldn't be those areas. But if you had a golf course where you had a lot of trees and grassy areas with vegetation, maybe between fairways or at the edges of the golf course, there's a possibility for some ticks there. So you'd really have to look at a small scale. There may be parts of a golf course that could have ticks. There may be other areas like the fairways, which I said are just too open and dry, and ticks wouldn't do well in those areas. Now, in terms of the tick tubes, so there are actually devices you can purchase which are called tick tubes, and these are cardboard tubes, and inside is some cotton balls that have been specifically treated with permethrin, and what happens is the mice or small rodents come in, they grab the cotton to use as nesting material, and the permethrin doesn't harm the mice, but it will kill ticks that are on them. The problem, though, is with do-it-yourself recipes. So my understanding is if you look at the insecticide product label for permethrin, you have to follow those instructions explicitly because it's registered with the EPA and the federal government. And if the label doesn't say that you can spray cotton balls and stick them into tubes, you legally can't do that. It would be a violation of the pesticide label. So tick tubes are sold by manufacturers, but in terms of producing them yourself, you're technically not supposed to do that because the pesticide label doesn't say that you can.
Let's go to the phones. Esty and Madison, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. So probably 6 weeks ago, something, I started noticing very tiny flies that come and go out of my indoors plants. I'd never seen them before, and they're very active, and I wonder if you know what they are and if they might damage my plants, and if so, what I can do about it that is not chemical, that is organic.
Okay. Are the flies that you're seeing, are they fairly dark colored, like blackish, dark brown?
Yes, and tiny.
Okay. So my suspicion, when I hear of small flies around houseplants, we have a type of insect called a fungus gnat, and these are generally blackish, and even if you got the wings under magnification, they have kind of this black or smoky, hazy appearance to the wings. And these fungus gnats, true to their name, they feed on fungi and fungal spores and things like that in damp environments. And so they can be very common around houseplants. What that tells me is that the houseplants are maybe being watered a little bit too much. Because if you have overwatered houseplants where that soil is kept moist, that can be great conditions for them. So you had asked about non-chemical approaches. And one of the very simplest things that you could do would be to reduce the amount of water and watering, and basically water less frequently. Many indoor plants can actually tolerate this fairly well. And if you just water less frequently and allow the soil to dry out more between waterings, that's going to produce conditions that are really inhospitable to fungus gnats, and they're going to have a very hard time surviving. So that is often one of the simplest things that I recommend to folks. If you do have a really heavy infestation, there are some soil treatments that you can get as well at the garden center. But for now, I would simply try watering less and see if that will reduce their numbers over time. One other thing you could do, you can get at the hardware store or garden center what are called sticky card traps. And these basically look like a yellow index card, and they've got sticky glue on them, and they come with little stakes. You can put them in pots of your indoor potted plants, and the adult fungus gnats are attracted to those a bit, and so that can help capture some of the adults. That's something good that you can do in addition to reducing the amount of watering. And over time, those traps can help also monitor for trends, because if you swap out the glue board traps every couple of weeks, you'll be able to see if you're catching fewer and fewer over time. So that can often be very helpful as well.
Thanks very much for calling. I'm sorry? Yeah, appreciate your call. Let's go to Mary in Door County. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Very happy to speak with you. We have had all of our ash trees taken out. They were killed by the emerald ash borer. Now they've been taken out. However, on our wooded lots, we have many ash seedlings, and they vary in size from 3 inches to about a foot and a half. Should I just destroy those, or would they have a chance long range?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting topic. And this is something that, as a scientific community, we're still trying to figure out exactly what is going to happen in these situations. So for the time being, those small ash seedlings aren't going to be attacked by emerald ash borer. They're simply too small at the moment. What'll happen is as they get larger, they're going to get to a point where they have a big enough diameter that emerald ash borer, if it's still in the area, can go to those. So again, this is something that we just haven't seen it play out long enough to know what's going to happen. Ash trees do produce an awful lot of seeds, and so it doesn't surprise me to hear that you have these seedlings popping up. Will they make it in the long run? My suspicion is going to be that most of those will probably be killed off. There is a slight chance that if one of those seedlings had some type of genetic change that offered some tolerance or resistance to the insect, it may be able to survive. We have seen a bit of evidence of this in places like Michigan, which has had emerald ash borer a lot longer than us here in Wisconsin. There are some areas where emerald ash borer has gone through, killed most of the trees, and yet there are certain trees that are surviving. So again, there is a chance that some of those trees might have a genetic tweak that allows them to hang on.
All right. Thank you, Mary, for calling. Jerry in Linden Station emailed. He lost his three-year-old chocolate lab to what the vet said was from a tick. It caused an aneurysm in her brain, which caused loss of motor function, blindness as well. Seemed like it happened overnight. Is this related to the Western tick? Also, he's noticed white-colored ticks on his pet rabbits after some outside playtime. Each rabbit had a couple of ticks. They were all a whitish color.
Okay, well, first off, regarding the dog, I'm terribly sorry to hear about that. When you think about ticks and tick-borne diseases, I mean, we have two or three main species of ticks in Wisconsin. All of them can carry certain diseases, especially the deer tick is our biggest threat. Wood ticks can technically carry things like Rocky Mountain spotted fever, but we have very, very few cases. That one's pretty rare, and we don't see many disease issues with that. But when you think about things like deer ticks and the diseases that they can carry, some of those diseases can cause lots and lots of inflammation throughout human body and body of animals as well. And so that can cause all kinds of bad things to go on. Certain ticks can also cause paralysis under the right conditions. So I personally have not heard of ticks causing that type of symptom that occurred in this dog. But as I said, some of the diseases and pathogens that they can carry can cause lots and lots of inflammation, which can cause all kinds of bad things to happen in the body. In terms of the light-colored ticks, that really has me kind of scratching my head a little bit. I'd be curious to almost see some of those ticks under the microscope just to know what species there are. There are certain ticks, for example, that are very fond of rabbits, and you see them on rabbits, but they wouldn't go to dogs and things like that. But another thing that might have happened is if you have ticks that attach and they start feeding, what will happen is over the course of several days, the tick's body basically expands. They kind of balloon up because they are ingesting blood for their blood meal. And that can take them from that typical kind of brownish or reddish color, depending on the species. And their swollen abdomen or the part of their body is basically going to have a pale kind of grayish color. So if the ticks seem to be kind of swollen, that would be my top suspicion, is that they might have been attached for a while in feeding, and that caused them to swell up and have that pale color. But if you do see more of them, you could always send some of those into the insect diagnostic lab here on campus, and I can get a better look under the microscope and give the caller a much more precise identification on those.
So, Jerry, if you get a photo, or I'm sorry, get some ticks, you can go to the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab online and figure out how to mail those in. Thank you very much for that question. Let's go to Lee in Green Bay. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, good morning. I would just like to have PJ comment on the worldwide and also in this country, the loss of our insects and what ongoing research is being done. I know farming has contributed a lot, loss of habitat, introduction of herbicides, pesticides, what's going to happen in the future, especially with our pollinators, how it's so serious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lisa, I really appreciate that question. It's a topic that we could talk about for probably a whole hour because it's such a big topic. The short story is that there have been rumblings about insect declines for years and years. Some of this, is just general observations. Folks would drive up north and wouldn't have to wipe off their windshield as much, that sort of thing. But just in about the last 5 years or so, there's been a building body of evidence, and scientists have really started to document this much more and more. And so there's a lot of studies out there indicating that insects are declining, and this is declines across the board. So pollinators, of course, are at risk. But we're talking about insects across the board and just loss of general insect biomass, which is really concerning when you think about it because of the ecosystem services they provide for us. Pollination, breaking down and decomposing organic materials and all kinds of other things as well. So it is really alarming in terms of the factors that are involved. You already mentioned some of them. It's things like land use changes, the landscape in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the U.S. and around the world has changed dramatically just in the last couple of hundred years. We have shifted towards intensive agriculture, where we have miles and miles of corn or soybeans, relatively low diversity systems compared to 100 or 200 years ago. And so that's one part of the puzzle. We do have farming practices like insecticide use and pesticide use in general. Some of that might not be directly harming the insects, like some of the herbicides, but if they're taking out plants that might be a food source for them, that can have impacts as well. And so there's really a lot of these interacting factors that are contributing to insect decline. At this point, though, we have lots of questions still. When you look at some of the review studies that have looked at insect decline, we have a bunch of studies in the U.S. We have a bunch of studies from Europe, but there's other spots on the globe where there's almost no research that's been done, places like Africa, for example. So we don't know the full extent of what's going on at this point, but it is very alarming because of the overall importance of insects that we are starting to see this building body of evidence for these declines that are going on out in the environment.
Lee, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. PJ Leash, our guest today, great to have him with us. He directs the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Jill Nadeau is our producer, Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with PJ Leash, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Questions, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you could also call us at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Cheryl in Berlin, we'll go to you next. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. My question is just actually in the last few weeks, I have so many anthills in my yard. They're just destroying my yard. Is there anything that I could...
Yeah, and I'm guessing there are these large anthills, Cheryl. Oh, maybe we lost her. PJ, I'm guessing that's what she's got.
Yeah, so we are at a time of the year where there's a lot of ant activity out there. Many of our ant species have essentially woken up from their inactivity during the winter months, and so they are out there kind of trying to establish territorial borders and secure resources and that sort of thing. So not uncommon to hear about lots of ant activity this time of the year. If it is ants where there are very, very large mounds in the yard, where maybe a mound is the size of a dinner plate or so, that is generally going to be one of our species of field ants. And these can be fairly large ants. They can look somewhat similar to carpenter ants in terms of their appearance. And they can produce these very large mounds. As I just said, it might be the size of a dinner plate, for some species, that mound can actually be a couple of feet across and really mounded up. Other times, it's more relatively flat at the surface of the ground. The trick for dealing with these, if they are in a spot that is causing issues, because it's, maybe in a garden plot or, it's disrupting with mowing the lawn and stuff like that. There are treatments for them, but the caveat is that the queen and the bulk of the colony can often be a couple feet below ground. So what you would need to do is get a liquid ant control product from the hardware store garden center. And rather than just mixing it up according to directions and pouring it on the soil surface, that might not soak in all that deep. So what you need to do is take a dowel rod or broom handle or metal rod or something like that and try poking a couple channels down into that nest as far as you can push it into the ground. That's going to make some channels for the liquid to flow in there more easily and get deeper. And that usually does the trick for those large ant mounds, Larry.
Thank you for that question. Appreciate it very much. Back to photos. A listener emailed to ask if this photo is of a centipede hatch or something else that's happening on a maple trunk or log in a greenhouse. And I think you can see that. Looks like a bunch of worms.
Yeah, so I did
almost
see the photo come through, Larry. Those are actually millipedes. And it makes perfect sense. So millipedes are what I think of as recyclers. They help break down rotting plant material, and they'll feed on fungi and stuff like that. And so if you have a rotting stump or a log, and in this case, I can even see in some of the pictures some mushrooms growing there, that's great habitat for these millipedes. So they can be very common in a situation like this.
Karen in Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Karen.
Good morning. So have a little bit off subject, but not really. So I have horses, and I started using feed through fly control. So it goes through the system, it goes into the manure, and it's supposed to kill the larva, and you won't have as many flies on your property. So it is controlling it, but the strange thing is my horses have these little teeny weeny black flies on them, like lots of them. Is that just baby flies, or is that a different type of fly?
So that would be a different type of fly outright. So if you think about a horse farm, there are certain flies that can breed in and be associated with manure, like house flies and stable flies. And so the treatment that you're giving, where they essentially ingest it, and that's going to prevent them from breeding in the manure, that's going to take care of those flies. The flies that you're describing would be something different. My suspicion might be something along the lines of black flies. In general, when you look at insects, and this is true of flies and all other insects, only adult insects have fully formed, fully functional wings other than mayflies. That's a weird exception. You can get a subadult stage that can fly. But if you see an insect that's flying, we know it's an adult insect, and adult insects don't grow or molt or get any larger. So if you see a tiny flying insect, that's not a baby one or a young one. That's a fully formed adult of a species that just happens to be smaller. So those tiny black flies or flies that you're seeing must be something else, and they may possibly be black flies if they're biting type. If they're not biting, there could be some other possibilities as well.
All right. Thank you very much for that question. A listener emailed regarding black flies. They have found that Absorbean Junior will keep them away. It's a liquid roll-on product found at the pharmacy. I doesn't know if it'll work on horses, but it worked great for a group of golfers who were being surrounded. Absorbean Junior.
Yeah. Yeah, so I've actually heard of that, Larry. And when it comes to black flies, so it turns out that our standard go-to repellents like Beet and Picaridin and some of the other ones out there, they might help a certain extent with black flies, but they don't seem to have as much repellency as they do against other flies like mosquitoes. With all our black fly species in the area, we've got about 30 or so different species. There may be some subtle differences. So I have heard of folks trying Absorbine Junior. There's a chance that it may work, that some of the compounds in there, kind of the herbal components, might have some type of repellency. I haven't seen any specific scientific studies, though, in terms of if there is indeed repellency or how long it's going to last. But, you know, if you have some on hand, you certainly can try it. Just keep in mind that we don't know how well it's going to work or how long it's going to repel them for.
Glenda emailed a photo for identification, a bright yellow insect. It looked like it'd be a great fly for fishing, but or a lure for fishing, but do you know what it is? A bright yellow with a, looks like a reddish stripe down its back.
Yeah, so I did take a peek at this one, Larry. We have a caterpillar called the white marked tussock moth, and this one looks pretty close to that, except on the white marked tussock moth, and this caterpillar in the photo that the individual sent in, it's very fuzzy and yellow. On the white marked tussock moth, there'd be these pale tufts just behind the reddish head. And on this species, they're yellow. So it tells me it's probably a very close relative of the white marked tussock moth from the genus Orgyia, which is O-R-G-Y-I-A. So if you hopped online and searched for that, you should find some more information about that particular caterpillar.
Ron in La Crosse has a comment. Ron, hi.
Yes, I have a suggestion. Your guest was talking about getting rid of ants that burrow like hemter ants and are 2 feet into the soil, and they need to use a broom handle or something to use a particular product, but not according to the instructions. You need to sink it deeper. I would think maybe a root feeder, if the product is soluble in water, if you make a solution with that product, you could put it in a root feeder canopy. Normally, if you know what a root feeder is, you put a fertilizer pellet at the top in a sort of a plexiglass canopy, and then you connect it to a garden hose, and water runs through it, and then it goes through a rod to some and comes out some holes in the bottom of the rod. That if that product is water soluble, you could probably use a root feeder to distribute it 2 feet down or so.
What do you think, PJ?
Yeah, so that certainly is a really interesting idea. I had not thought of that or heard of that myself. However, you know, that might be another way to get that ant control product down deeper into the soil where the queen and the bulk of the colony may be. So kind of gets at the same thing where you're just getting that product deeper into the soil. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if that worked fairly well.
Like that idea, Ron. Thank you. Bennett called in to suggest planting native plants to help control bugs. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I mean, personally, I'm a big fan of native plants in general. We are hearing some rumblings in the scientific community about you know, benefits of native plants, especially for our native insects. We just talked about insect declining numbers recently on the show. And we know that if we put in native plants and we have native insects around that have evolved for those plants, that may provide a food source or a home for those particular insects. So it certainly can help out. In terms of repelling or keeping away insects, though, I haven't really heard of that. If anything, I would suspect if you're putting in a diversity of native plants, you're probably going to be encouraging insects to show up in your yard, which may not be a bad thing. Again, with insect declines, that might actually be a good thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And Cal had called to let us know that Permethrin, and back to that for a minute, it's also, you mentioned many places you could get it. It's also available in many of the big box stores as well. And then Karen in Door County emailed that she's thinking about planting a linden tree, but she hears they are Japanese beetle magnets. Anything that she should consider when planting one?
Yeah, so the caller is absolutely right. When it comes to linden trees, lindens are one of the very favorite food sources of Japanese beetles. When the trees are relatively small, you can protect them by doing sprays and stuff like that, but there have been some concerns with pollinators in linden trees because lindens can be very attractive to bees and other pollinators. And due to those concerns, you can no longer use many of the systemic products on them. So historically, you could apply a systemic product to the soil around a linden tree. It'll get taken up, get into the leaves, and protect the leaves. But again, we have concerns because that might harm bees or other pollinators. So we can't do that anymore. What that means is if you have a large linden tree, which is maybe 30, 40, 50, 60 feet high, we really don't have any great management options for those. So it is a challenge. Some good news, though, is that most plants, unless they keep getting defoliated severely many years in a row, can do okay in the long run. And even if you have a tree or a shrub that gets completely defoliated one year, it most likely will be okay the next year. When a tree or shrub gets defoliated again and again year after year, then I start to worry about kind of secondary issues popping up because that tree is maybe running a little bit ragged, so to speak. So, I mean, my general thoughts is that if you really like the idea of a linden tree, I'm certainly not going to tell you not to put one in. They can be beautiful trees. Just be cognizant about Japanese beetles. You might need to do some things to kind of protect the tree while it's new and smaller before it's had a chance to become established. But once that tree is larger, again, they can tolerate a fair amount of damage. And even though they might look a little bit bad, they can actually do okay in the long run.
P.J. Leash, our guest today, he directs the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm going to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us. And then coming out of that break, we're going to be zeroing in a little bit on mosquitoes. they're coming. They're here. PJ's got some interesting things to talk about with mosquitoes. And that'll be right after this look at the news. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. If you have a question or comment about insects, we'd love to hear from you today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. P.J. Leash back with us, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. So have you seen an unusual bug? What questions do you have for P.J.? Give a call at 800-642-1234 or shoot an email to ideas@wpr.org. Many people are doing that and enclosing photos of insects that they typically wonder what the heck they are. So we can do all of that for you as well. Before we go to Mark and Merton, though, I want to talk about mosquitoes. Lots of rain in at least parts of Wisconsin this week, and it's warmer. So what does all that mean for our mosquitoes?
Yeah, so that's a million-dollar question, Larry. I've been getting that question a lot just over the last couple of weeks, and so a lot of folks have been wondering what's the mosquito season going to look like. And it was really interesting this year because statewide we have been running a little bit drier, and that can, to a certain extent, limit mosquito populations. However, as you just mentioned, some parts of Wisconsin recently, like in the last couple of days, have been getting a decent amount of rain, and if the rains keep up this week, that may play a role as well. Now, when it comes to our mosquitoes, we have close to 60 different species here in the state, and they each have their own unique biology and life cycle and so on. Some of the mosquitoes can actually overwinter as adults. So I got some of my first mosquito reports couple months ago once the snow melted and things warmed up. Those mosquitoes usually aren't particularly abundant, though, so still it's been relatively quiet. In a typical year, I see our big first batch of mosquitoes for the year usually around Memorial Day weekend, give or take a week or so. So we're right at that point of the year where we might start seeing more. What I'm concerned a little bit about is especially for southern Wisconsin, where we got quite a bit of rain, things have maybe puddled up out in the woods, and that might set the stage. And if we have that water sitting there now and some warm temperatures, which are also on the way, that might lead to some pretty good mosquito numbers in a couple of weeks. So we have to stay tuned to see just how bad the mosquitoes will truly be for this year. But at least parts of Wisconsin have had pretty good conditions to potentially set the stage for good mosquito numbers.
And they don't need a heck of a lot of water to lay their eggs in, do they?
Right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, something as small as imagine the bottle cap from a bottle of water. If you were to take that cap and put it on the ground, fill it with water, and then put in a little bit of a dead leaf or similar organic debris, which they use as food, you could easily raise a dozen or two dozen mosquitoes in situations like that. So it doesn't take much at all. In our own yards, that could be a little bit of water that is pooled up in a tarp or maybe in a partially clogged or clogged gutter. And if you have little bits of standing water around, even in your own yard, that can lead to the production of some mosquitoes very close to where you are.
Mark in Merton, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
I have an ant question. Thanks for taking my call, by the way.
Sure.
I usually would see, ever since I've been a little kid, this great ant hatch in late August, early September. They just would swarm out of the ground, and it was really noticeable. If you were painting a house white, it was a really bad time. So this year, for the first year, I did not see an ant hatch. And usually at the same time, you would see lots of nighthawks. At that time, they were taking advantage of it. Over the years, I've seen fewer and fewer nighthawks, even with the hatch. But last year, I did not see an ant hatch. Do you guys keep track of that kind of thing?
Well, I do to a certain extent. I did actually have last year and the last couple of years actually quite a few reports, but these reports of that big ant hatch or swarming event in late summer really varied from location to location. And I do remember being in certain locations some years and you see a huge batch of these and, you know, maybe you don't see in the next year. Sometimes these can be a very ephemeral thing. And so you could literally be out for dinner or at the grocery store and just away for a couple of hours, and you can easily miss one of these swarming events because they might emerge. You see them flying around for 2-3 hours in some cases, and then they're just gone like it never happened. So that could be a slight possibility. But otherwise, for around the state of Wisconsin, I had quite a few reports this last year, especially around Labor Day weekend in early September. But the last couple of years, I've had lots of reports of that. So it's a very common phenomenon that time of the year for those particular types of ants.
Oh, there we go, Mark. Thank you for calling. Pete in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Pete.
Hi, guys. Love the show. Just wondering about tent caterpillars. I'm seeing a lot of them lately, especially on the wild cherry trees. And I just remember being a kid in the 70s, my grandpa and dad used to light them on fire and stuff like that. And I just want to know what kind of moth do they turn into, and are they harmful to the trees, or what's going on with these things?
Yeah, great question. So what you're seeing are eastern tent caterpillars, and they're very common this time of year. I've seen quite a few myself. I've had lots of reports from around the state. They're just one of the very common spring caterpillars that we see every single year. As you had mentioned, Pete, they're really fond of trees like black cherry trees out in the woods. They do also occur, though, sometimes in yards or in orchard settings, in apple or other fruit trees or in crabapple trees as well. They don't go to a super broad range of trees, but the crabapples can be a common one in addition to the black cherries and fruit trees. Now, in the grand scheme of things, I often hear reports similar to what you mentioned, where folks think they need to burn these tents and that sort of thing, which in my mind is a little bit overkill. They really don't cause that much damage. I mean, these are native insects. Our plants are used to them. Even if you had a fair amount of defoliation, those trees have ways to put out another batch of leaves for the year. And the eastern tent caterpillar only has one generation in spring, and then they're done for the year until the following spring. So in my mind, they really don't cause that much damage. Now, if you did have a fruit tree that you're concerned about because you want to maximize your production of apples or plums or pears or whatnot, or an ornamental crab apple that, you know, you want it looking as nice as possible, there's not necessarily a need to burn the nest, but what you could do is simply go in there, especially during the daytime. The caterpillars, once they get big enough, like to hide in that silken tent during the day so that birds don't eat them and they're protected in there. You could take that tent and simply rip it out and squish them or knock them into a container of soapy water. That would dispose of them. Or you could take a tree or shrub insecticide spray and spray the tent directly, and that would be a way to take out all those caterpillars. You could even spray that tent with a concoction of basically soapy water or insecticidal soap, and that will take care of them as well. So, again, they're really not that big of a threat, but sometimes in certain trees, certain settings, we want to do something, but no real need to burn them out.
Thanks, Pete. Appreciate the call. Matt emailed a photo of an insect he found dead on the sidewalk yesterday. I'm looking at it right now. I hope you can see it too, PJ. It was close to 2 inches long, and he's wondering what it is.
Yeah, so I did get that picture from Matt. This is a type of insect called a stonefly, and given that size, it's most likely one of our giant stoneflies from the family Pteronarcidae. These are generally associated with larger rivers and streams. So I don't think I saw in Matt's email his location, but my hunch is there's probably a pretty good sized river or stream nearby, because the juveniles, the larvae, develop in those locations, and then the adults will fly to lights and things like that. So again, the juveniles develop in the rivers and then the adults will fly out from there. So I've seen plenty of these myself this time of the year up near like the Wolf River, Shawano area, for example, but they do occur many spots in the state.
And while we're at photos, Ruth sent a photo or an ID of something white and black, I believe, in color.
Yeah, so this one was another millipede, actually, Larry, and we do have a number of different millipedes out there, and they're associated with damp conditions, so very, very common outdoors. Occasionally, they will sneak into structures like garages or into homes where they don't live very long. It's simply too dry for them. So they can be a little bit of a nuisance around the house. One of the best ways to deal with or prevent problems with these is simply making sure that your home or other structure seals up really well. So good weather stripping on doors and windows, that sort of thing, making sure you don't have gaps or cracks in your foundation. Those types of approaches to physically seal things up can go a really long way.
Let's take another call. Ann in Maple. Thank you for calling, Ann. What can we do for you?
Yes, I have ants. They're kind of a larger black ant, and they're not in hordes, but they periodically appear on my kitchen counter, and they run away, and I smash them down. But then I put up the hummingbird feeder, and I had a whole layer of them just floating on the sugar juice in my hummingbird feeder and wondering where they're coming from and how, why are they attracted to sugar? I don't know.
Some are. PJ, comment.
Yeah, so the caller had mentioned that the ants are larger black ants, which makes me a little bit suspicious that they might be carpenter ants, which can be very common and very active this time of the year. And if you can get some pictures of these, or if you want to collect some and send them to me in the mail, I can get you a more definitive answer. But simply hearing that, that's my top suspect on the moment. They might be carpenter ants. There's a couple other possibilities out there, too. In terms of their diet, carpenter ants can go to sugars. Sometimes their diet can vary depending on the needs of the colony, but it doesn't surprise me to hear that they're going to something like that. Now, in terms of where they're coming from, that's a really good question, which I can't answer at this point. However, you may be able to figure that out. One really good thing to do with carpenter ants and ants in general, if you want to find the source, sit there and watch them. And you might need to watch them for 20 or 30 minutes or even an hour But often, if you simply watch them, you'll see them maybe collect some of the sugar as a food source, and then watch them and see where they're going back to. If they were going to a rotting stump or a firewood pile in your yard, that would tell me it's probably an outdoor nest, and you could maybe, you know, do a little bit more detective work and perhaps find the nest and deal with it that way. But if they were, say, going to the side of your house, which might suggest the presence of a nest in your house, then that might be more of a situation where you need to step in and do something about it. So simply observing the ants can be a really helpful approach at this point.
And the hummingbird feeder, ants do like to invade hummingbird feeders, don't they?
Yeah, any type of readily available sugar source. You could get ants or at other times of the year, things like scavenging yellow jackets and paper wasps will readily go to materials like that as well.
Thank you, Ann. Jan in Antioch, Illinois, we'll go to you. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Larry and PJ. I have a horse also, and I'm still stuck on the flies. Recently, I have just decided to purchase what they call fly predators. They do not give us the name of the predator so that we know exactly what kind of a creature it is, but it looks like a teeny tiny wasp. And supposedly you spread these out in the paddocks or areas around where the horses are, and they give you an amount of 1 to 5 horses, approximately 5,000 of these predators. And every month they send you a new bag, and I'm kind of wondering, is it worth it?
Yeah, so really good question, and it's an interesting topic. So these fly predators that are sold as the name fly predators, they are essentially a teeny tiny little type of wasp. Now, these are wasps that aren't going to sting humans, so they're completely harmless to us. What they do, though, is they attack and parasitize the pupae of flies, such as house flies and stable flies, which can be a significant problem on horse farms and other livestock farms as well. So by using these fly predators, it's a way to essentially help control flies using biological control. And I have spoken with a number of folks here in Wisconsin that have used these with pretty good results. As you mentioned, you do have to keep re-releasing these throughout the growing season or the warmer months. So they don't last forever. You do need to keep reintroducing them. But in many situations, it may be a way to greatly reduce the amount of spraying that you have to do for flies, or perhaps eliminate spraying entirely. It may be more expensive, but again, it is a non-chemical option. And as I said, they basically, you introduce these and then they help parasitize some developing flies that may be around manure out in the pasture or the manure pile.
Thank you very much, Jan, for calling. Roger in Grantsburg, we'll go to you. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Well, I got a comment here on ants and mosquitoes. I live on a farm with farm, whatever. There's always tires, old tires on farms. Oh, my God. They were any poor water in tires, mosquitoes. You know, a tire builds up, you get 6-7 inches of water in it, you've got thousands and thousands and thousands of hatching mosquitoes. When I was in the dollar store, I'll find, like, bottles of cheap dish soap. Find them for whatever, 50 cents, a buck, whatever. Walk around, whatever, before I got rid of all the tires. Put a little squirt of the soap in there, and the film on the water kills the mosquitoes from hatching. They're like puts a film on it and they can't hatch. Oh, yeah. When you get rain, if you put too much in, then you got bubbles everywhere.
Oh, Roger. Well, that's one way to do it. PJ.
Yeah, it does bring up a really interesting point. If you wanted to design an object that was just about impossible to shake out of the water, all the water out of, it would be a tire. And so we do know that tires can play a really important role in terms of mosquitoes. And there have actually been cases where Invasive non-native species of mosquitoes have been introduced because of tires. Tires getting shipped around the world for recycling or repurposing purposes, or being shipped around for being sold elsewhere. We have even situations here in Wisconsin where I know of non-native mosquito species have been introduced from the southern U.S. In tires, essentially. So we do have a concern with that. Folks that have maybe a tire yard where you have a bunch of specialty tires for tractors and stuff like that, they will sometimes use larvicides, which Roger was getting at, basically a way to target and treat that water in there, which is a way to prevent mosquitoes from developing in those locations. So they do have some other products out there, like certain bacterial-based products that the mosquito larvae would feed on, and it would kill them that way. But soap, it wouldn't surprise me if that would work as well, because, again, you are modifying the water that's trapped inside there and making it so that the mosquito larvae might not be able to survive. So you're kind of hitting them at the source when you do that.
A listener emailed that lily leaf beetles are already active in Vernon County. Aside from neem oil, what other advice can you offer?
All right. So for lily leaf beetle, and for callers that aren't familiar with this pest, lily leaf beetle is an invasive species of beetle that feeds on true lilies and a few other plants like fritillaries and Solomon seal, and they can cause some significant damage. They won't feed on things like daylilies, but true lilies seem to face the brunt of the problem here in the state. And this is an insect that I've been watching and tracking it around the state over the last 6 or so years since it showed up here in Wisconsin. Again, it can be very damaging. So if you have these on lilies in your yard and you do nothing, those plants are probably going to fare really poorly and look pretty crummy as well. So we do have some options for dealing with them. You could spray them with neem oil or azadirachtin. If you're looking for another organic option, some other things to consider might be a spinosad, which is sold as Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew, or you could try pyrethrins as well. There are also some conventional products that you could use, which can last on the plants and protect the plants for about a week or two at a time. The important thing to keep in mind with any of these treatments that you're using on lilies, lilies are flowers, and so there's a chance that pollinators may be going to them. So we want to make sure not to spray the flowers themselves, but spray the greener parts of the plant, the leaves and stems and things like that, to protect that part of the plant from this insect. Some other options, especially if you have just a smaller patch of lilies, you could consider going out there, and you'd have to do this every day, but you could knock them into a container of soapy water or grab them by hand and squish them. That would be an entirely non-chemical way to deal with them as well. So there's a lot of options. You have to tailor the management to your particular situation, the number of flowers, how big of a flower bed, and so on.
Yeah, very, very good advice. Well, I tell you what, PG, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Sorry we can't get to everybody, but that's always the way it is. You'll be back, and we'll do this again. I wanted to mention again, as you listen to PJ talk, if you've got an insect issue, often a photo to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, or as PJ's been saying, if you can get some real insects, the ones that you want identified, mail them to the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he can take care and take a look at them under the microscope, maybe it'll take, but come up with an answer for you. PJ, again, thanks so much. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
PJ Leash, he is the administrator or manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Just wanted to mention once more, we've got a new blog post up to help you with your garden selections. It includes ideas for cool weather plants, compact shrubs, and how to add year-round fragrance to your garden. Just go to wpr.org/Larry. Tomorrow we talk with the author of a new book for kids that helps them learn about nature and how to explore it. And then Shyla Mergain comes back to talk about post-lockdown anxiety. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.